Welcome to the 14th episode of the Global History Podcast. I'm Chase, your host for today's segment, and today I'd like to welcome Craig Lambert and Stephen Mentz. Craig Lambert is Associate Professor in Maritime History at the University of Southampton. In his own words, Dr. Lambert's primary research focus is on maritime history, especially the study of maritime communities, merchant shipping, and naval logistics circa 1300 to circa 1600. He is the author, co-author, and co-editor of several academic works on these subjects, including Agincourt and Context, War on Land and Sea, Military Communities in Late Medieval England, Essays in Honor of Andrew Ayton, and Shipping the Medieval Military, English Maritime Logistics in the 14th Century. Stephen Mentz is Professor of English at St. John's University in New York City. In his own words, Professor Mentz's research focuses on Shakespeare, 16th and 17th century English literature, environmental humanities, eco-criticism, and oceanic culture. He is the author of several academic books on these subjects, including Ocean, Break Up the Anthropocene, and Shipwreck Modernity, Ecologies of Globalization 1500 to 1719. And he is the editor or co-editor of Oceanic New York, The Age of Thomas Nash, Text, Bodies, and Trespasses of Authorship in Early Modern England, and Rogues in Early Modern English Culture. Along with Claire Jowett, Professor of Renaissance Studies at the University of East Anglia, these two scholars are also co-editors of a new edited volume, The Routledge Companion to Marine and Maritime Worlds, 1400 to 1800, which was published this year. About 3 weeks ago, I spoke with Craig Lambert and Stephen Mentz over Skype about this new volume, discussing subjects including how the book situates itself into scholarship on the late medieval and early modern oceans, the importance of interdisciplinary approaches in writing about the sea, and the significance of the period 1400 to 1800 in the history of maritime worlds. Listen on to find out more. If you have any thoughts, questions, or comments about the episode, feel free to email us at theglobalhistorypodcast@gmail.com or send us a message on our website, Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. And just a note to say that if you're listening to this on our website, we're also on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and Google Podcasts if you'd prefer to listen on one of these platforms. Hi, Craig and Steve. It's wonderful to get the chance to speak to you about your new volume. I'm sorry Claire can't join us today, but that's all right. This is a very exciting new volume, and I'm glad to have the opportunity to ask you a few questions about it.
Well, we're looking forward to it.
Yes, thank you so much.
Glad to be here.
So I'd like to begin by asking you about the overall framing of your volume, which I think is in many ways a survey of the state of the field, this kind of broad field of the sea, studying the sea in a global perspective. So this is a rather a broad question. But as you were putting together this book, what are some of the main trends in the academic literature that you were observing? And how does your volume fit into these trends?
That is a wonderfully broad question. I mean, I can take a swing at it maybe, and then I'll pass over to Craig. And I think that, I mean, a couple things. One is our effort in this book, and you know, these are all, like, as with all academic labors, it's aspirational and incomplete, and we're trying to do things that we don't yet know how to do, which is like how academic culture changes and gets better. But we were really thinking about trying to be global and multicultural, multidisciplinary in ways that is difficult to do. I'm not saying that there's nobody doing this kind of work now, because I think there definitely is, including all the people we found to contribute to the volume. But the sense that histories of the ocean, histories of maritime culture will get more interesting as they get more global and less parochial was all on our mind from the very beginning. It was one of the things that drew the three of us together from our quite different subspecialties. You know, between literary culture and archival history, and it also really motivated the way we were looking for people to contribute. And we also, as we went through the volume, we sort of, in our editorial correspondence with our contributors, we really pushed them in that direction, like to see if we could, you know, go to places that we haven't gone before, which sometimes was in tension with the idea of being a survey of the field too, right? So some of the articles, some of the chapters in the book really are sort of like state of the field in this little corner of the maritime discourse, and some are really doing new work, new archival work, and sort of showing how materials that haven't been worked with before can help us. And so that is both a tension and I think a kind of complementary structure within the book. I don't know, you want to say more about that, Craig?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point, the idea about how, so there's obviously genres within maritime history, such as Atlantic history, and you got the Pacific world, and sometimes these are separate entities in a way. And even within those particular fields, you have somebody that might look at a particular town on the Atlantic coast, and therefore it's like a micro history and then thrown out to be. And we have those in there, you know, Gary's chapter, for example, on the two ports in. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we've widened that out. So if we look at Reeler's chapter and the others, Isaac Land's, we've got that kind of push-pull, and I think a nice balance between people engaging with, you know, really in-depth, locally sourced archives, but at the same time, people standing back from it and taking a more global perspective, which kind of segues its way through all these different variants of maritime history quite nicely over the 25 chapters, including the introduction.
Yeah, no, I think it's a really interesting approach. And I'd like to kind of ask you about another element of that kind of these points about the kind of academic literature as well. So I found this sentence from your introduction quite interesting, very interesting, actually. The idea that, and I'm quoting now, once traditional and often Euro-chauvinistic depictions of the conquest or mastery of the ocean during the early modern period no longer remain critical orthodoxies as maritime scholarship seeks to challenge these underlying assumptions. So I think this is a very important point, and I'd like to dive into this in more depth. So regarding geographic coverage of the chapters and the contributions and the theoretical framings of sources and research questions, in what ways does your volume try to contest these more traditional, as you call them, or once traditional emphases on Euro-chauvinism, mastery, and conquest?
Again, a very large question. I think if you step back from a lot of this, there's been a growing trend anyway. So if you look at African Agency, for example, which has actually got some really interesting materials out there at the minute, there's a really good group of scholars looking at this. So it has a much more wider thing about, because look, ultimately people working in the 18th centuries, 19th centuries, were using texts that were written by Europeans, how they were describing interactions very much. So you're getting a Euro point of view. More recently, that has seeked to be challenged. You know, I'm working on an article at the minute on the slave trade, for example, and much of it's focused on what is actually happening in Africa and what's the agency that they're involved with, just as much as it is about what the Europeans are doing. And looking at it from the Africans' point of view, the world looks very different, you know, and it's not as if the narratives we have are actually the European narratives are that useful. So if you look at something like Isaac's chapter in the volume, which I found really interesting, when Europeans enter a port city, be that in the Pacific or South Asia or wherever, they enter them on different terms. They don't go in there on European terms. And they adapt it all sorts of ways. And Rhodes' chapter on the Ottomans as well, you can see many English people go over there and they become acculturatized to that particular area. So I think people flipping the coin, if you like, and looking at it from a different perspective, it, you know, runs hopefully through quite a lot of chapters in the book.
Yeah, I very much agree with that. And I think that's one of the real contributions that this volume makes to the sort of collective discourse. I'm also just really pleased to Chase, to know that sentence sort of jumped out at you, because I think that was in some ways like the first sentence we wrote together when we were writing the book. I think it might even be in the proposal or and like I sort of have a dim memory several years ago of sort of talking about this. I think our editors met in person exactly once at the British Library back when like people met in person. You know, and that we were, you know, we were thinking about what it means to give up on Eurocentrism and also discourses of mastery, and like what are the, because we're like, we and the people we're in dialogue with here are massively interested in skills and tools and technologies and archives, right? So we have like the work in the collection on shipping technologies and on record keeping in port towns and on naval operations are, you know, wonderfully intensely detailed and kind of fine studies of expert knowledge. But I think once we open up to collaborations, as Craig mentions, from Africa, from Asia, from the New World, that there's a way of thinking about maritime skill and expertise that isn't quite so chauvinist, right? I mean, that was the word we sort of collectively came with as the thing we want to push back against. And like, if there's a single thing that the volume does collectively, that would be the thing I would be most eager to see, you know, readers, scholars, graduate students take from this book.
Now I think it's really interesting you mentioned that you met in person once, or at least initially. And I do think that's actually quite an interesting point. So regarding kind of collaborating in this kind of transcontinental global project, what are some of the main challenges that you faced in putting together a volume like this?
Well, I don't know if we want to unveil too much of our. It was a long process. I can say that, and we actually are. We are one publisher down over the course of the process of this book. It had been originally contracted with Ashgate Publishing, which vanished into the deep sea. I think that I'll speak sort of briefly to the experience of collaboration. Is that like the joy of collaboration is working with people who know a lot more than you do on different subjects, right? And that really was, for me, very much, I was very conscious throughout, both with my fellow editors and with the contributors, that there's a lot of stuff in this book that I was learning about as I was going through it. And I think that'll be true for almost any imaginable reader, that the range of the book is outside and beyond the expertise of any single person. And I think that, you know, the three of us coming from quite different worlds, from archival history, and I'm much more a literary studies person. Claire, in some ways, is the bridge between us. So she's not on the call right now, but she is both, you know, in some ways working across both worlds and connecting them in really fascinating ways. And I think that range was the thing that kept this sometimes wayward journey like always going, right? There was it was really wonderful working with Craig and Claire, and also I feel like I learned so much from the process.
Yeah, I mean, there's the actual kind of intellectual journey, isn't there? And then there's the kind of the kind of how do you frame it, put it together, the kind of the emailing constantly between contributors, you know, the actual kind of mechanics of it, I guess.
Yeah.
Which in some ways tend to just roll, your relationship with each kind of contributor is slightly different, I guess, to the other one. Sometimes I knew them quite well. Other times it was the first time I'd ever met them. And those kinds of processes went okay. I mean, look, there's 20 odd people that we were dealing with over this across the kind of globe, and it was so I mean, yeah, standing back now and thinking about it was like that's a big ask, you know, but it ran relatively smoothly, and it's everybody, I hope, in the editors has learned something from it.
So I just like to pick up on something you said about methodology, about the interdisciplinarity of this project. You mentioned specifically your different expertises as editors, but then even of the contributors, there's people from many different disciplines. So why do you think the study of the sea in a global perspective needs to be interdisciplinary, or at least needs to be more interdisciplinary?
I mean, it's through such collaboration. I mean, me as a kind of dyed-in-the-wool archival historian, we can produce things that are very much focused on what we do, but at the same time, working with literary scholars and other things, it adds flesh to the bones of the archives in so many ways that we don't have. And it's same even when you cross over with science as well. You know, I know quite a lot of people that are doing some really interesting things with historians linking with poor towns who are looking at climate change and think, I mean, there's some really exciting stuff going on there across wide disciplines. And so I think that it complements them in so many ways, rather than just having a straight, you know, 20 chapters focused on archival history, say, where you have all this cross-pollination as well of ideas and how things interlink together quite nicely. You only get that from an interdisciplinary approach.
Yeah, no, I would definitely second everything that Craig just said. And I would also talk about maybe just there's like a collective response to the evidence that exists, right? So that like we do have multiple kinds of evidence. We have physical objects, we have, figureheads on warships that survives. We have archives from, trading companies. We have poems. We have paintings, you know, and so we need different methodologies to do justice to the different kinds of archives that survives. And we also have, you know, through the sciences, we have the ocean itself is a physical archive, and other kind of climate archives. The other thing I would just sort of mention, and this has been one of the real things that I think has been both generated by this book, by the process of bringing all these people together, is the opportunity for collaboration has changed in our, you know, increasingly digitally mediated world, right? I mean, it is true now since March of 2020 that like everything happens on Zoom, but even before that, the ability to work with people across the Atlantic, around the globe, to build things, to make connections between different kinds of academic work through, shared Zotero bibliographies and things like that. It's really changing, I think, the way that cultural history, social history, literary history gets approached, the way we're building this kind of work. And I hope that this volume is both a sort of testament to that and also a demonstration of like, this is why this kind of stuff is so fun and interesting and useful. And like, it shows the kinds of possibilities that this new form of collaboration can create for us, even if we can't be in the same room with any other people.
Yes, I hope that will change soon, but of course,
yes, I do too.
Of course, it's impossible to tell at the current time. So one thing I'd like to pick up on that you just said is this kind of sheer range of source materials and genres of sources that your contributors have drawn upon, which I think is one of the strengths of the volume, and I think is so, so important and very interesting. From very diverse sources. So you mentioned science, but for example, like from cartography to literature. So I was wondering, could you please elaborate on perhaps a few of these materials? I'm quite interested in how different types of materials can tell us different stories about the sea. And I was wondering if you could comment a bit more on this.
Maybe I'll just draw out one quick example from Claire's paper, since she is not here, Claire's chapter. She has this really wonderful and rich chapter on early modern maritime heroes and the idea of heroism that draws from both, records of famous maritime heroes, you know, people like Drake, but also on, well-known literary texts, on, Shakespeare's plays. And she sort of builds it into this reading of a particular ship at the end of that chapter in a way that I still remember sort of how exciting it was to read this when it came, when she submitted it to us as her fellow editors. I was like, what a great chapter, what a great way to bring together the different kinds of materials, the physical archive of a wooden ship, right? A ship that is had an existence in time and in space, and also a cultural existence. So that reading that physical object in dialogue with, Shakespeare's Macbeth and in dialogue with the journals of people who sailed with Drake enables a sense of the kind of, I mean, it was the most exciting kind of cultural history because it draws, for me, because it draws on all those different kinds of material archives and conceptual, intellectual, linguistic archives.
I think one of the other reasons, if you've got, say, commercial records, for example, they can tell you, you know, where a ship goes, what it does, what it carries, who some of the people are on there. And you can map English voyages or whatever, going to places. But then if you link it with the chapter we have on maps, for example, which kind of shows how then people are visualizing that in different ways. So, you know, gradually Europeans are sailing a bit further and a bit further. And then this school in London kind of is showing you how they're thinking about that, but doing it more visually. And also how they were doing it in other European countries as well. You know, just focusing on the maps that were made in other parts. Again, it's the physical voyage linked with the kind of, you know, how that then goes on onto a chart, you know, a map. And I just found that quite interesting, seeing how you've, on one record, you've got almost like dry economic data, if you see what I mean. Yeah. And on the other one, you've got it, how it emerges in, how people visualize it, basically, different to what the commercial records show. And I think with, you've got these chapters sitting alongside each other in this volume, I hope that comes through, that that people get that when they read it. So that's important, why to have different people working on different things using different sources, and sometimes, as with Claire, bringing them both together in the same chapter.
Mm-hmm. Now I think I'd like to pick up on something you've both mentioned. So Craig talking about physical and visualized perceptions of the sea. And then Steve speaking about Claire's chapter and the physical space of the ship as a kind of space. So I'm really fascinated by this concept of maritime spaces. So whether they were spaces of emotion, like fear or wonder, or visualized, as you mentioned, through maps or printed on paper or through poems and literature, or as lived spaces of encounter and trade, like ships, as you mentioned, and also port cities, as you were talking about earlier. So I think this idea of space is quite important to your volume, and it's something that I'm very interested in. So why is it important to conceptualize maritime world as grounded in place and space?
I mean, my first thought is that it has to do with mobility, right? That so much of the material, like one of the master phenomena that we're looking at across all, you know, 25 chapters plus an introduction, or maybe that includes the introduction, is, you know, ships go places, right? Ships are about connecting places that are unlike each other. Even if they're just like going from one port town in the Mediterranean to another, they're still like bringing together differences of ecology and human culture. And so the attention to, like, you know, the shipboard space is something that is consistent, like it's the same ship in Plymouth as it is in Goa, but it's also, you know, totally changing because the people are changing, the food is changing. There's a fantastic chapter on you know, the health of sailors, and you know, like the problems in keeping sailors alive in the East India Company voyages in the early 17th century, which was like a real problem. And, you know, the structure, legal and other kinds of structures that are meant to sort of keep stability in what is almost definitionally an unstable act, or a dangerous, risky, you know, an act that is working through change and also trying to hold on to some kind of stability in that change.
No, and I agree wholly with that, because it's all about space and place. From the, as Steve says, you know, the space of the ship, you know, as its own, as Cheryl Few and the others talk about, it's got its own kind of world. But then you arrive at a port, and if you read Isaac Land's chapter, then you're open into, it's suddenly you're into a kind of, oof, you know, it's a totally different area with its own, and each has its own rules. And this is what's interesting, because the ship has its own kind of shipboard culture, you know, but then you go to Malacca or somewhere, and then as soon as you enter that place, you're in bang. And that, you know, seafarers have to react and adapt to those different settings. I mean, it's, you know, obviously you can't go back in time, but it's kind of really interesting to see how, or imagine how that happens, you know, And ultimately, you know, it's the space of the ship into a huge place. And then you've obviously got the vastness of the ocean itself anyway, which I mean, must have brought all sorts of thoughts as people went round, particularly those going down into India, you know, the swinging right out into the Atlantic. Then, I mean, it's a long voyage. So I think no matter which part of maritime history or culture you look at, space and place is always part of it.
So I'd like to think a bit more about spaces here. So another idea that I thought was really interesting that comes out in your volume is this idea of the sea as a space of the attempt to kind of impose order, but also to subvert order. So in what ways did, for example, early modern states, and I suppose individuals as well, try to govern and control the sea? And to what extent would you say their efforts were successful?
that's not all that
successful.
I mean, it varies. There's a lot of localized law. Each country, each port people went into, there were different areas, there were different rulers, there were different people all interacting. A European perspective, you obviously had law codes from the medieval period. And ultimately the Court of the Admiralty and things like that develop as we go into the early modern period from the 14th century. And there are odd claims made. So Edward III and 14th century English kings would often claim that they were Lord of the Sea, for example. But there was no real legal or physical way they could impose that, other than on a very enclosed space. Like if something happens in London, you would therefore be under the law of the common law, whatever they were dealing with. I think as you expand, and that's what our book covers that period as well, as people start coming into contact with each other more, it also, you were, like I say, you end up into different areas and different localities. You know, when the Portuguese arrive in India, they're dealing with rulers they were more powerful than them on a local level, and they have their own way of negotiating legal process. So it's tricky, it's difficult, and I think as Richard Blakemore's chapter, I hopefully conveys it evolves into a certain thing, but the evolution was never planned or determined. It kind of it happens, you know, over a period that as European states as well, in particular, get more and more proactive at sea, they start to try and enforce laws a bit more stringently. The Portuguese try to do it in India, you know, they go down there and initially they cause a few problems, and then they start trying to implement their own like protection racket, basically. But in a sense, it's creating its own form of legal process while they're doing so.
Yeah, I was thinking about that question, which is such a great question, like how do you impose order, political order, on a sort of a physically unmarkable space, right? And I was thinking that the, like, taking the chapters as a whole, we're thinking of like the imposition of order on a disorderly space is a kind of obsessive recurring topos in these chapters. But the order, I mean, there's a lot on law, a lot on pirates and privateers, a lot on navies and naval operations in John Hundorf's great chapter. But there's all these other mechanisms that are used to impose order and stability too, including music, including ship design. Margaret Schott has a great chapter on nautical manuals and ship's instruments, which are also ways of ordering the ship in space and, you know, sort of, celestial space as well as terrestrial space. And so the desire to impose or manufacture a kind of order in a disorderly world seems to be a kind of, like, yes, legal order, yes, kind of economic order, because there's a lot also about trade relations in some of these wonderful chapters about especially trade in the Eastern Mediterranean and also in the Far East, but also order in a kind of, you know, like humanity in the cosmos kind of order that is also under strain as you go to these strange places in the world. There are places that are unfamiliar to You know, and I'm thinking, you know, we've been tending to think, and I think a lot of our chapters do think with sort of India and the Far East, and we also do have chapters that think about the Americas and the influence of things like American agricultural produce, which was, you know, radically transformative to European cultures. And, you know, we have a great chapter by Mac Test on the New World potato, and the potato, which was like this exotic kind of sexy vegetable in the early modern English period, shows up in plays and poems. And it is like weirdly transformative, the sort of most prosaic part of our diets today, but the sort of transformative effect that what Tess calls the transatlantic tuber has on, you know, diets and cultures in Europe and among sort of throughout the world.
So I think another idea that it's really important to emphasize and not forget is this idea of the sea as a space of violence and exploitation. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to ask you, so what kinds of roles did violence play on the early modern seas and maritime worlds? And why do you think that the study of violence and exploitation, or at least remembering and foregrounding it in our histories and analysis of literature and other sources, why do you think that the study of violence and exploitation is important in the study of the sea in global history?
I think in terms of violence, there's different ways that you can look at this or examine this, and how you look at it on the ship, for example, as people, you know, and you know, Cheryl's done Elaine Murphy talk about this and write about these kinds of things. There's some strange things go on as well as some things that you would expect. At the same time, though, there's also there can be a certain perception that it's a violent space when sometimes it might not be. And I can give you a good example. I've been recently going through some High Court Admiralty records, and the shippers on there talk about being captured by pirates. That's what they describe them as. I've yet to come across an account where the person taking the ship, the pirate, actually uses violence. What they often do is they are more force in the sense there's more of them and they've got stronger weapons or whatever. So the other ship just surrenders. They usually put them in the cabin and lock the door and just take the stuff and leave them, and they cut the sails. It's very and there's been some good work as well on the medieval sea recently that's suggesting the same thing. Now, that's a kind of small scale thing. But when you then go to say, oh, Vasco da Gama or Alfonso de Albuquerque going down into, they bring all sorts of preconceptions with them. Of course, the Reconquista, you know, they've been fighting Islamic forces in North Africa for God knows how long. And they bring all that baggage with them, and it creates a kind of violence towards certain sets of people there, which, you know, creates problems. And of course, remember, there's also violence between inter-European. So when the Dutch arrive there, they want to move the Portuguese. So it creates all sorts of problems. And I've just been reading some really interesting things on West Africa at the minute and about how climate, for example. So there's a really long dry period from about 10,000 to 1500. It has a massive effect on population movements in and around West Africa. That creates a lot of kind of competition, as well as cultural exchanges, but like warfare. And of course, the Portuguese were voyaging down there at that time. That's that world that they arrive in. And so sometimes they engage in it, sometimes they ferment it. It's a really complex world. And of course, that then leads to the exploitative nature of kind of the slave trade and the horrific stories that go on there. And that runs, I guess, you know, all the way through navies, slave trade, you know, contacts, piracy. It's a kind of common theme, isn't it, throughout maritime studies?
That seems like a great reminder of this sort of complex interpenetration of African agency, climate change, you know, other sorts of global phenomenon in the, you know, period of the origin of the transatlantic slave trade. I'm also thinking about the question about violence, and it seems to me that there might be a useful distinction between violence and risk. That going to sea in a wooden ship in the early modern period is an extremely risky proposition. Lots and lots of people get sick. Lots and lots of people die. And it is, you know, my chapter in the book is about shipwreck and the way shipwreck is sort of always present as possibility, even if the ship like makes it to where it's trying to go. So famous cultural ideas about shipwreck and sort of icons and prayers against shipwreck, that there is a way in which this kind of knowing assumption of risk is deeply baked into maritime culture. And I think it also has a relationship to the, human against human violence that is so common both in, you know, in the slave trade, in colonialism, in piracy, that you know, in both the kind of assumption of risk to natural or sort of more than human forces and a willingness to inflict violence on people that you meet or people who are on your own boat for that matter.
Yeah, I think sometimes it's very difficult to study or read about these topics, but I think it is essential to remember the place of violence and risk as well, as you note, in these histories. So I thought this particular idea was interesting. So I'm quoting again now, this idea that maritime trade created commercial networks, but as so often, cultural exchange was the bedfellow of economic contact. And I think this interplay between trade and cultural encounter is so important and is definitely a big part of your volume. So why were commerce and cultural exchange entwined in these maritime worlds that you study? And why is it important to think of them together rather than solely as separate phenomena? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I think that trade and cultural exchange are both necessarily together. I think about the, you know, the complexity involved in a trade negotiation between cultures that don't know each other, whether it's in West Africa with the Portuguese in the early 15th century or a little bit later in India. How do they actually accomplish trade, given the massive disparities in cultural knowledge and cultural assumptions that they, you know, and sometimes there are translators and middlemen and brokers of various kinds, including pilots. You sort of need to have some kind of cultural communication in order to make possible the exchange of goods that is, like, theoretically, I guess, the purpose of the voyage, you know, to get the spices or whatever. You have to go through the culture to get the economics, I guess. So this is the way I might say it.
Yeah, I think obviously, as Steve mentioned, you, as people go to places for trade, they also have to understand the culture. You know, it's the physicality of things like weights and measures, all that kind of stuff. How do you deal with this? And so often, I mean, you get it in the accounts now. And there's a lot more literature emerging on this. Is, you know, how connected these were. So people would say go from West Africa and they go and live in Portugal, you know, not as slaves or anything, but, you know, learn languages, things like that. It's all that kind of idea about how you can link in. I mean, some of the people, like the chieftains in the Congo, for example, started to take on Portuguese names. It's a really interesting mix. Caroline Dodds Pennock has actually just wrote a really interesting thing in the American Historical Review called Aztecs Abroad. It just came out, the latest volume. Really interesting stuff there about how, you know, Aztecs, which we often see as kind of victims, if you like, but had a really proactive role of going over to the Spanish courts and in some ways knowing the system, the Spanish system, and ensuring that they got favors and things like that, and ensuring, in other words, that they actively... proactively and some of these people had Spanish names, of course, because, you know, some of them were fathered by the conquistadors, you know, they met local women and things like that. So it's a real kind of melting pot. And ultimately, you know, if you go somewhere to trade, you have to pick up local knowledge. And I mean, I know the thing going native's a bit passé now, but I think that there's often times where people would go, and particularly into the Ottoman court as well, in particular, where Englishmen were sent over there. And, you know, I kind of got a vague story of one of the ambassadors having an organ, you know, and all this kind of thing, and like really getting involved with Ottoman music and stuff like that. So he's sent there as a trade envoy, essentially, but he becomes kind of meshed into that culture. I mean, so they're inextricably linked, really, and you can't mm-hmm. kind of separate them. There's also a lot of things as well where the Portuguese and the Indians, you know, bring a lot of, like, the string instruments, you know, music is changed, you know, by these kinds of things. So there's a lot more interaction on this as well, you know. Ultimately, they're there to trade and do things, but that swings with it as well.
Right. Yeah. And thinking about cultural encounters as moments of performance, I know that there's been a lot of sort of discussion in my literary sub-discourse about, you know, like, is it really true that they were performing, you know, Hamlet on the deck of a ship? And, you know, it seems like maybe not, but certainly the idea that the ship entering into distant waters is consciously producing a kind of performance for the West African kings or the Indian or the Ottoman cult, like there is a way in which that like the study of performance is also a way of thinking about diplomacy and trade relations.
Yeah, definitely. So I think the cast of characters in your volume is vast, just like the sources that are being analyzed. And I think that this is important, the idea of bringing in a wide variety of people and actors into your story. So what were some of the challenges that you faced in foregrounding individuals whose voices and experiences are generally more likely to be marginalized? Not always, but on average, more likely to be marginalized in the historical record concerning maritime worlds. So, for example, slaves, women, or indigenous peoples. So what types of challenges did you face in bringing them into this volume?
I mean, I think we sort of passed that challenge on to our contributors in a real sense. And I think that, for example, Marguerite Lincoln's great chapter on women in the sea, 1600 to 1800, sort of squarely faces the both the material that the archive makes available to us about the relationship between women and seafaring, both as, you know, both in port towns and at sea, and also faces the challenges of it, right? That's not the kind of archives that have been most, you know, like those aren't the archives we inherit in a kind of nice, neat way from the historians who came before us. And so I think that thinking also about the indigenous archives in Mac Tess' essay on the New World potato, about how, you know, in a lot of cases, what he's working with are European texts about indigenous Americans, but also trying to, you know, use what we know now about Native American culture in the early modern period to enable us to sort of reread or read against the grain in these, you know, Elizabethan plays, for example, that describe Native peoples.
Yeah, I agree entirely with that, Steve. Yeah.
So I'm quite interested in these kind of non-human agencies as well. So in the ways in which animals or diseases or even the ocean itself might be conceptualized as historical agents in the narratives that your contributors are telling and that you're telling through this volume. So I was wondering if you could just comment a bit on the place of non-human agency in the study of maritime worlds.
I mean, that of course is a vast chapter, because I mean, a vast question, because I mean, you know, I know these ideas, you call it the Columbian Exchange or whatever you want to call it, you know, this idea that you know, and Tess' work on the potato is like part of that in a sense, you know, that obviously you've got plants, animals, everything moving around. To some extent, you know, humans have to be involved in that movement. You know, there's some proactive nature by humans. You know, they want to take coffee from one place and plant it in another, you know, things like that. The potato, obviously, you know, I would assume is seen as a very staple food crop from the point of view of the Europeans arriving over there. That's a very useful kind of thing. So it's, I think they're kind of interlinked in a way, you know, the human interaction on the sea with I mean, I can't remember whether it's in, whether Cheryl talks about it here or, and Elaine does in other parts of her work as well, you know, about sometimes what happens with animals on the East India Company voyages, you know, and there's some accusations we won't go into there. But, I mean, it's a very complicated picture.
Yeah, it is like fascinatingly rich and kind of intricate in the local. I would also just say that one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot in relationship both to this project and other work is as I think you mentioned in your question, the sort of agency of the ocean itself. And I'm thinking particularly of the network of ocean currents and gyres, which have such an incredible shaping and forcing influence. And like, when you're sailing from Europe to the Americas, you know, you go where the ocean gyre takes you, more or less. And the structure of, for example, the Indian Ocean seasonal monsoon, which also really controls and you know, facilitates certain kinds and patterns of trade and cultural relationships while inhibiting or almost prohibiting others. And so the way in which the ocean as a non-human agent is a powerful player in this story, I think, is like it, you can see it like stick its little salty fingers into lots and lots of the chapters in this book. But I also think as a sort of overarching conception, it is one of the great you know, alien presences with which history is made.
Yeah, I liked how you personified the sea there. It's very interesting. So I'd like to kind of zoom out a bit and think a bit more broadly and ask a bit, a few larger questions about, I suppose, the framing of the book, the direction of the field, and the relevance of this field to our world today. So first, I'd just like to ask you about chronology. So I think that the late medieval, early modern chronology that you foreground is really interesting. And I'd just like to ask you, why is this periodization, this period really, important to studying the role of the sea in global history? And what makes it special, say, in relation to what came later or what came before?
On one level, of course, it's part of the age of expansion, if you like, where people come into contact with each other on a more regular basis than they had before. Now, of course, areas themselves are quite connected. The Pacific world is very connected. You know, the American world is very connected. You know, the canoes and everything that used to go around. It's all 1400 to 1800. You're kind of getting much more globalization effect, aren't you, where people do come. And some of that, as we discussed earlier, ends up in violence, but other times it ends up not so in other in very interesting ways. You know, food is changed, all sorts of things happen, you know, diets are altered. I mean, it's a chunk of a 400 year period ish that has all sorts of going, and in effect, you know, what happens after 1800 is largely building on what has kind of gone before. You know, the British Empire, for example, you know, it gets more powerful arguably in the 19th century, but it's building on the foundation that it's created in that 1400 to 1800 period, just as one example.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with globalization as being, you know, a kind of distinctive feature of this period. I mean, there's obviously lots of maritime trade going on before and after, but the kind of novelty, including the kind of ecosystemic effects of, you know, Afro-Eurasian diseases and the massive catastrophic effect on New World indigenous populations, and other kinds of, I mean, again, the Columbian Exchange is the sort of accepted term. I would sort of rather move away from that one. And I think about this in terms of a wet globalization or an oceanic globalization, and partly to not think about individual heroic Europeans at the center, because I don't know that they always were. But there is a kind of transition moment in this period to greater interaction and more consistent interaction between the continents and across the wide ocean basins. It's not saying there was none before that. There was some, both across the Pacific and the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. But the putting together of the full puzzle seems to happen substantially, at least in the period that we're investigating here.
I think it's interesting you mentioned globalization, which is, of course, one of the key interests, not the only by any means interest, but a key interest of global history as it has developed. So in what ways does centering the sea help historians and scholars of other disciplines as well think beyond the restrictions, say, of individual nation states and empires? And why do you think the sea is important in moving beyond this way of thinking about the past?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've already sort of hit on one of the key political questions, is that the sea asks us to think beyond nation states. I mean, in some ways, in our period, it also is, as Craig alluded to just a minute ago, it's a sort of proto maritime imperial project, which will come into being a little bit later, or come into sort of full legal, political, structural concept. But the seeds of it are being planted here. I would also think a little bit about the sea in the kind of non-human agency terms that we were just talking about a minute ago, that the sea makes visible to us a massive non-human body on which we depend. We as humans are in a position of weakness rather than a position of mastery, which comes back to that sentence that you talked out of our introduction at the beginning of our conversation, is that in relationship to the ocean, individual humans tend to be in positions of vulnerability rather than mastery. And I think that that's an important kind of caveat or change to the way we think about political and poetic as well kinds of structures of meaning in the world.
Yeah, I think Steve just hit on the really key thing. You know, there's this vast kind of body of water, isn't there? And it does all sorts of things. It's essentially, you got to think, it's a highway, isn't it? Just as much as a kind of barrier in many ways as well. And that's the whole point. That's the global bit of it, isn't it? You know, it brings one part of the world to another part of the world, and therefore through that contact comes a meeting, and so. You stop looking at nation states and you start looking at kind of, and I guess in some ways that's why, you've got this growth of like Atlantic studies, Indian Ocean studies. You know, people want to look at it more as a large space, much more going on than a particular country and how it interacts on there. So I think there's a growing interest in this anyway across the academic field. And it can be very small scale, or it can be people looking at, I've read some very conceptual pieces recently on, what it means to study Atlantic history and things like that. I mean, it's really a kind of moving academic field, I think, this. And of course, the sea's right at the centre of it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I would add to that, is that thinking about climate, thinking about the relationship between the sea and climate, and obviously this is a pressing and urgent question in the present, in an era of anthropogenic climate change, but also the sort of way in which coming into different climates, changes the way Europeans think about themselves. I'm like, what does it mean to be a European in a climate like the American tropics, where it like doesn't seem to work that well to be a European in the way you're used to being a European. And so this sense of the ocean as both a driving agent in climate structures, we have a tropical storm making its way up the coast of Connecticut to my house right now. One of the particular weather patterns, which is a west side of the Atlantic more than an east side of the Atlantic sort of thing. And so it represents something which is perceived as novel by early Europeans in the Americas, and also just the sort of dependence of the sailor on the weather is an interesting model for the way in which global civilizations today are in this kind of structure of vulnerability and dependence in relationship to weather changes.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'd like to kind of pick up on that because I think that is, it's so important because I think when speaking about the ocean, it's impossible not to think about the current climate crisis and environmental degradation, which I think are really important to discuss. So in what ways do the environmental humanities and thinking about these questions, which are often, I think, seen as perhaps more the domain of scientists and social scientists and public policy specialists rather than say the humanities or historians or of scholars of other disciplines of literature specialists, what can the humanities bring to the study of the ocean from the perspective of these pressing questions about the climate today?
I think that there's some interesting things. You can look very much at a micro level or a very focused level. So I've got a colleague in geography who's very interested in medieval climate change. He works on the port of Dunwich in Suffolk, which was washed away in the 12th century and then several periods thereafter by storms, flooding. But yet it continues to work as a port. So we were linking his data where he cores down and he can map storms on the scientific core, and then our historical records will tell us, you know, whether it's writings or documentation will tell us whether or not. And we can see as well in manorial records all around the medieval coastline how local coastal communities often dug kind of trenches and ditches and sea defences. And one of the interesting ones that used to happen down in Sussex, which is actually happening a lot more in England now, I don't know what's going on in the States, but it's just letting the sea actually reclaim bits of land rather than fighting it. It's letting it come in, and because what they found before is when they do things up coast, it has an impact on what happens down coast. So we've got a very big bird reserve on one part of the coast in the east, and the sea defences they were building on the upper coast further northeast, we're changing the currents, and it's washing all the mudflats away, you know, which the birds kind of feed on and things like that. So, and this is again, you know, geography linking with history, trying to work out what's going on. How do these things? There was an interesting project a while ago. Royal naval captains in the 18th century used to do weather reports in the logs. Mm-hmm. Someone then figured this out. Okay, we can get all these logs together and see what was the climate like in the 18th century. You know, and how is it different now? So, I think there's a lot of really interesting ways people can use documents to say, you know, scientists have models, and there's a really good book by Bruce Campbell on climate change as well in the like late and medieval going into the early modern period. Mm-hmm. It came out about a year or so ago, and just it has a massive effect on all sorts of things, your population movements, warfare, encouraging people to kind of do things that they wouldn't have normally done, even on things like maybe bringing the Black Death over in terms of how the environment has the steps and moving the animals, all that kind of thing is kind of involved. So it there's a lot of lessons there that can be learned. It's certainly about, I think, linking up. And that goes back to the point at the start. Interdisciplinarity is really important, I think, and hopefully in the next kind of few decades, a lot more interesting linkage with humanities and sciences really produces some interesting thoughts about this.
Yeah, I very much agree with that. I think that's a great way to describe the value of historical studies of climate change and the things we can learn about past history of humans dealing with changing climates. I would also say on a maybe more conceptual type scale that the you know, the sort of poetic history of how we think about the human relationship with the ocean is also a cultural record of how humans imagine themselves encountering a hostile environment. And in the Anthropocene, in our age of catastrophic climate change, our environment is becoming more like the ocean. Like all the sort of green terrestrial fantasies are getting, you know, are subject to sea level rise in the present. And so I think one of the reasons, and I talk about this in more literary kind of work that's separate from this project, but one of the reasons I think that returning to the kind of archive of sea poetry right now is so important is it provides us with a model for thinking about how do we encounter a world that is not particularly hospitable to us. It doesn't mean that we can't live there, but we can live there under these conditions that are a little bit more tenuous and strained and painful. And the long history of sea poetry, you know, from the Odyssey to, this great book by Alice Oswald that I just picked up a couple weeks ago, is speaking to that question of how do we deal with the vulnerable human body in the vast oceanic fluid space. And that's an environmental question as well as a cultural one, it seems to me.
I think both of your different points here are really important. And I think they lead me quite nicely to my last question. So I'd like to end with a reflection on the significance of thinking about the oceans today. So in the introduction, you put it quite nicely. I think you speak about oceanic thinking in the past. So why do you believe that on one hand, studying oceanic thinking in the past is important, and also perhaps oceanic thinking today? So why do you think it's important to continue thinking about studying and reflecting on our relationship to the seas?
I read something a while back, and it was the point that it was, you know, posing the question: did people in past societies, were they more connected to the sea than we are today? And thinking about that in all sorts of ways, and some of the work that I've done and what my PhD students are doing as well at the minute, you can kind of get that in certain places where people, you know. A baker will also be a ship owner, and he'll run a ship around. Mm-hmm. He's moving wheat and bar. You know, whereas now, is it more a kind of a leisure space? Oh, I'll go and use my yacht or whatever it is, or my jet ski. Mm-hmm. You know, that kind of thing. And I thought it was a quite interesting piece that the person was kind of writing in there, in the sense that, you know, how did, you know, what's going on in the past? How are societies connected with it? And it's really important now. Going back to the previous comment as well, like what Steve was saying, no, there's a thing like, you know, it's called silent spring. You know, it's when you get up one day and you don't hear any birds anymore. And it's mm-hmm. the kind of same thing that's going on with the ocean as well. I think that's the present. It's, you know, when you go down, sometimes you're lucky enough to see a kind of big dorsal fin coming out. It kind of moves you in a particular way. And that, I think, you know, puts me squarely in the present. And you know, I'm a maritime historian, so I think about the sea all the time. But I don't know whether or not many people do, other than they see it as an object to cross or something to get on an outboard motor on or something. I don't know. That's why I think it's important to keep focused on these things as well. But it also teaches us, you know, more about, you know, we're looking at all this stuff that's coming out at the minute. I get it's probably as big in the States as it is over here. Black Lives Matter statues, all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's linked with oceans, sea. You know, mm-hmm. most of the statues that people are targeting over here are people connected with the sea. You know, and it's directly impacting our present now. You know, in all sorts of ways. I mean, so I think it's a really significant topic.
Yeah, I was thinking about that in particular, looking at the video of the statue of Colson in Bristol being dumped into the harbor. And I mean, yes, the sort of oceanic history of abolition is also really interesting to think about through figures like Equiano and quite a few other, you know, like it was through maritime trades was one of the ways in which enslaved people in the Americas managed to both either buy or escape into freedom. And so the kind of way in which the oceanic network also becomes a vehicle for the circulation of abolitionist ideas and abolitionist texts as well, things like Equiano's narrative. The other thing, oceanic thinking has this really fascinating historical backstory that we're trying to surface in these chapters. I also just finished proofing an article I wrote on oceanic feeling, both in sort of Freud's famous sense and also just in a kind of more material sense. What does it feel like when the ocean touches human flesh? I'm thinking here, as Craig already talked about, the sort of shift in the sea as primarily a space of labor to primarily being a space of leisure in sort of wealthy modern nations in the present. All of these things, I think, are ways in which ocean thinking in the present enables us to place into historical context things like environmental change, globalization, including, you know, contemporary globalization driven by container ships rather than, you know, pirate ships or slave ships. And so, like, for me, at least, the ocean as a connective body has this extraordinary capacity to bring together multiple ways of thinking, ways of feeling, and also, as we show in this book, or we try to show in this book, multiple ways of accessing and making sense of the historical and material archive.
Well, I think that's very well said, both of you. Thank you. And I think on that note, I will end our interview. So thank you so much, Stephen Craig. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. And it's been a real privilege to have a peek at this exciting new volume. And I hope that scholars and researchers will find it useful and enlightening for their projects.
Yes, we hope so too. All right, it's been a pleasure talking to you, Jason. Yeah,
it's been a pleasure to catch up with everybody anyway. Stay safe.
Yes, you too. Yes, yeah. Please.
Thank you for listening to this 14th episode of the Global History Podcast with Craig Lambert and Stephen Mentz. If you have any thoughts, questions, or comments about the episode, feel free to email us at theglobalhistorypodcast@gmail.com or send us a message on our website, Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. And last but not least, stay tuned for more episodes coming soon.